Paul Marshman of 26 Uplands Road, Rowlands Castle, made on the 16th of August 2005.
Okay, this is Paul Leonard Marshman. I was born on the 11th of March 1947 at Waterville Nursing Home. I lived then at what we called Rats Castle at Finch Dean. It's the first thatched cottage on the road to Chorlton. Now very posh in one house. In those days it was two houses, very much dilapidated and old. It had a tin roof, not thatched in those days, and an unkempt garden, an outside tap, outside toilet of course, and no gas, water or electricity apart from the water butt and the outside tap. We moved into Uplands Road, which is new council houses, moved into Uplands Road early 1950. It was in a state of council houses, and I think it was purpose built for people like my mother and my father, children, after the war, when there was this a flurry of new houses for new people after the war. And I've lived there ever since. Yes. That was indeed a family of the modern nuclear family of father, mother, and my elder sister and myself into a three-bedroom house, which of course was sheer luxury. So we only had two bedrooms at all, the most at Finch Dean, and no bathroom or anything like that. It took a lot of time to get used to this new luxury, and within a few years of course I was starting school, which I hated, and I used to run away every day, but I was just taken back.
And you went to school where?
But I'd eventually stay there. This is of course the school at Red Hill, which is St John's Church of England Primary School, Red Hill Rose Castle, as it was known in those days. Even in then, that was of course 1952-3, it must still have been a church funded school to some extent, because the Reverend, in those days it was Reverend Force, used to come across and take lessons at a whim, and we had to have him for a teacher, for a master. It was mostly of course lessons on the scriptures, which we had to learn in those days. Maths, English, geography. They taught us painting and a lot of singing, and the music lessons were, I suppose, quite educational, because we could all sight read. In that, by sight read, that means we could play, but we could pick up a song and we would sing it there and then from the music. Whether that's good as any good or not. Yes. Yes, I remember the music lessons at school, and a very, very brief period of French lessons, so at least we weren't completely ignorant of French when we went to secondary modern school at the age of 11. Sports, of course, they taught us cricket and football. We had a master who apparently played for Arsenal, so he said, no one ever proved it. And the headmistress was Mrs. Bursey, who'd been there for many, many years. She lived in a school house. I can remember very, very hot days in the summers. The summers were always hot and scorching hot. And the winters were always freezing cold. It was so cold, my fingers. And it was just the one stove in the middle of the classroom. But that was school, that was school. From there we moved to Warbington, which had only been built for about 2 years by then. It was a new, huge, secondary modern school, which was very much the vogue in those days. There was others within a few miles in each direction.
How did you get?
We went to school by train, because we were within the pickup area of the train. There were children up in what we call the sticks, if you like, up at Finchdene at Lord Iswood. And there was a school bus which took them. It started in the village and it used to go around and pick up the children in line areas and drive to the school. There were some children from the Red Hill end of the village who caught this school bus as well, because it was considered too far for them to walk to the railway station. But we used to get the train to Havant and then catch the train to Warbington, and the station there is only 50 yards from the school. After a while, most children used to walk to Havant because it was just took a little bit extra, so them use your time, if you like, because it was a long wait on the Havant railway station. And then there's no harm to walk to school, and we all enjoyed it. We walked as a group and in smaller groups. And from Warbington, you either left in those days when you were 15 or 14 and a lot, or you stayed on to sixth form, which I done, to take GCSEs, of which I passed a few, but nothing important. And then you start work. But that's really me, not much of it in the village, is it? My first job was at Chidderstone, which was a long way to go, and I just became a production control clerk. And then eventually it was combined with the stores, so I became a storeman there. And again, when I left there and worked near at home at Wyeth until I retired. Okay, yes. At the age of 11, I joined the Boy Scouts, because my neighbours were all Boy Scouts, and he was slightly older than me, and the other lad across the road here was a Boy Scout, and so I had to join the Boy Scouts. But it was very enjoyable. Our initial interview was by Bruce Wayne, who lived in Lincs Lane. And we went and did his test one day, and they give you the initial interview, and they liked you. And then Bruce Way, who was skipper, used to pick us up in his Riley Pathfinder, 1950s, of course. And we used to go to Hornyeen, because that was a skate trip we had to join in those days. Now, the interesting point is that the first Rowan's Castle skates, or so they call themselves, are in fact not there. In fact, the second Rowan's Castle skates, because there was a skate group in Rowan's Castle before the war. But because so many Hornyeen boys joined it, they transferred to Hornyeen. And the 7 or 8 Rowan's Castle boys that were left had to go to Hornyeen to join the skates. And so it continued until modern times, when a lot of boy skates in the village formed their own group again, because there was enough of them. I didn't stay in the boy skates for too long, about 3 years. After that, for a short period, I did join the ATC, which is the Air Training Corps, of which there was a branch in Havant, and still is as far as I know. And again, it was peer pressure. There were slightly older boys than me in the village, and the same one said, come and join us, and it's good fun, and you get a uniform, and you get to fly if you're lucky, which I never did. I never did get to fly, but I did join, and they taught me to march, and to be smart, and that was about it, really. I can remember I was very, very good at map reading at ATC, because at those days I was also very good at geography. Geography is my prime subject at school, and of course I was still at school in those days. I mean, I'm talking about 14 or 15 year olds then. But as regards village groups, I mean, there was always football teams, of course, which we had to go and watch when you were a boy. We used to play at the recreation green, sometimes two teams on the same day, first and second team. Always Saturdays, of course, none of the Sunday football in those days. And there was always a mini bus to away games, which I can remember I used to catch and pay 2 or 3p to go and watch the village football team, usually no further than Portsmouth or Cranfield. And they did work their way up to the local leagues when the Portsmouth League was well known. It was a good quality league. The Premier Division was a stepping stone to the Hampshire League. The Hampshire, well, it was D4 in those days. We never actually made that. We made the Premier League for 1 year. And I can remember one day when we had all through the summer, we'd sign a man I can remember his name, it was Denny Hampshire, he might still well be around, I don't know, but he was the signing, he was the Vanessa Troy of his day, and he'd come to play for Rowland's Castle. I don't think there was any money involved, but nonetheless we couldn't wait, and he came and he was good, no doubt about it. He ran around and he scored goals and took players on, and yes, it was, these are wonderful days. It was Finnish football. Yes, 99% of the people were villagers as well. And likewise, the cricket team. At a fixed date, it was probably cup final day. That was it, no more football. No more football, cricket until the end of September. And, or certainly late September, when the football started again. So there was none of this pitch sharing and off-booted football run across our cricket square. No, it stopped. It was virtually the same people, of course, that played the cricket as played the football. And again, we played home and away games against local teams. We used to have lots of evening fixtures, mostly against naval teams from Portsmouth. And they used to love it. I used to love coming up into the sticks to play village bumpkins. And these naval teams consisted of admirals and lieutenants, and usually an American guest or two American guests at their team who didn't know too much about cricket. They used to hit the ball and throw the bat away, and everyone just ducked for cover and so on. But nonetheless, it was, and of course we used to be invited back down there to Exeland and Wow Island and HMS Farringham, and we used to be invited back down there. And of course they used to love that as well, because they used to take us back to their mess, the officers' mess of course, where it was silverware, and you were waited upon by people in uniform, and we couldn't make the same, we were terribly embarrassed, just huddled in a corner, and had to come out the huge place of sound just for us. But there were the days of the village cricket. It's not had any other one. Okay. We'll talk about the village fairs. The only village fairs I can remember were in Bowes Hill, in the grounds of a house, I think it was called Fairfield or Fairling, Fairfield I think, which is still there, but its grounds have been built on, four or five houses have been built on the grounds of it. There was a large marquee in the grounds. Tug of war team, which I can remember, which making lots of noise, and everybody used to go. One year, Tommy Trinder came and opened it. This was the most famous person anybody in the village had ever seen, and he stood there and he told jokes, and then sold his autograph for 5 shillings a time, which is a huge amount of money, because it was only about 1954, 55, and we thought he was a terribly mean person, but no ordinary person went, but I'm sure some of the richer people in Mixed Rainbows Hill went and got his autograph. It was held there for a few years, I can remember, and the next place I can remember being held was in the grounds of Dearley, behind the wall. I can't remember too much about those fairs. Again, there was coconut shies and the toys there, and the children's races, goes down that short lawn they've got, and the large tent with the produce in. It then faded for many years after that, until it was resurrected 1979, I believe. I'm not sure about the date, but it is in the records, the date when it was resurrected, and that was held on the village green. Other big occasions were the coronation of 1953, which was mostly held in the recreation ground. And I can remember this, and most two memories. One is of queuing up for the coronation mode, and the other memory was, for some unknown reason, there was a double-decker bus in the recreation ground driving rain. And that, of course, is like a young boy will remember. But that's all. That must have been around about the late 1950s. There was a fair, an old-fashioned fair, with roundabouts and sideshows and swings and lots of noise and sirens in the field in Castle Road. It's no longer a field, the houses are built there now, but this is the field to the right of the footpath which goes into the golf links. I didn't come very far this fair grade, as far as I got my cake, because my brother-in-law, who was caught on my sister at the time, and only came from Emsworth, took me up there, and he seemed to know everybody there. So I think it was quite a local affair. Fair indeed. Stop there. Yeah. We mentioned that from Uplands Road, as children, we had our own little green up there, which is still there. We played football and cricket on that at the right times. We used to build our own Guy Fawkes bonfire there every year as well. Or for everybody in Uplands Road, but just us children used to build it. We used to borrow or ask, mostly for, a few old tyres from Harry Hall's garage, and he always gave us some, which I throw those on as well. And the wood, of course, we used to get from Bluebell Woods, which on the map is called Cherry Row, but it's a piece of woodland behind Walesworth, which goes to White Hill. In those days, it was unfenced and had a well-defined network of paths through it, and we used to get there most days, most weekends, and play as children. We used to hunt pheasants with homemade bows and arrows. We never got one. We used to pick the bluebells. We used to go birds nesting up there. And as I say, we used to get the wood for the bonfire on November the 5th. We went to Stanstall Woods occasionally, and in those days, the remains of the war were still there. There was still a barbed wire compound there in Stanstall Forest, which we thought was for the German prisoners of war. But apparently it was there just to keep things in it. There was a lot of older people than me will tell you that the village children during the war used to help themselves to quite a lot of things. So I think it was probably the reason for that. There are still remains of the war, that war in Stanstall Forest, mostly bricks. But in my days, there were no more than bricks in those days, brick foundation. But this wire, barbed wire compound was still there and very much in evidence. In fact, you couldn't get anywhere near it because it was still quite dangerous. We used to go to the Holt occasionally. Holt used to be a great place for wild strawberries in those days. And of course, we used to go looking for golf balls. Golf balls, though, and looking for golf balls and caddying was really the job of the boys from Castle Road and King's Way in King's Close. We were very seldom asked to caddy up King's Road. We didn't know much about golf at all, and the area was virtually a bend to us, if you like. But nonetheless, the area from Links Lane to the Holt, we used to go and look for golf balls, and as I say, go to the Holt, and there was a wide pass through the Holt in those days. It was not overgrown like this now, and as I say, you could get wild strawberries over there. And if you're unlucky, you also saw an adder, in which case you all run home very quickly. It's a frightened the life out of it. It was well known for adders, and it probably still is these days. Yes, yes. In those days, and we're still talking mid-1950s, Uplands Road was unmade up until the council houses where the road was made. The lower part of Uplands Road was still unadopted, and it was still just flint with bramble bushes growing in it. And at the bottom of Uplands Road was a field with hawthorn trees and a bank. Otherwise, very short clipped grass, and we played in there. Again, almost every day. It was near the crash ground. It wasn't big enough to play football or cricket here. It was ideal for the classic children games of cowboys and Indians and bangers and robbers, because we could all run around these trees and hide behind each one and jump it unawares. There was very little traffic, of course. We used to play cricket in the road, using the lamppost, of course, as stumps. Okay. And apart from playing on the village green when there's a few more of us. Yes, going to school, of course, we had what you might call better public transport in those days, in that there were certainly two trains an hour in each direction, which to stop at the railway station. The station then was fully staffed, with a station master's hut, plus his own little house. signalman, because we had our signal, and we had the goods yard. And every Saturday morning, there used to be two lots of shunting. There used to be a long line that used to lead up to the railway arch called Courtland's Arch, and also the goods yard, and the bank above the goods yard, which used to be the remains of a somewhat ancient chalk pit. And from Uplands Road, there was a little path down to this bank, and we used to sit on this bank and watch the shunting every Saturday morning. I've written about to like steam a little bit there. Yeah. There's a cool part of the trains, there are buses as well. Again, as far as I can remember, two buses an hour, and that was going to Horndean as well. The buses come from Horndean, where there was a bus station, come from Rose Castle to Havant, and then turn back. Occasionally there were special buses which used to go to Dinnerlin and onwards to West Marden, up Forestside Hill, then to West Marden, or maybe Comptonford, I don't know, but I don't think so. Certainly to West Marden. And just occasionally, when the Singer Deckers came in, they used to go to Finchdean as well, under the railway arch there at Dinnerlin End. I can remember going to church on a Sunday in the afternoon, and in the evening, we would walk across the fields to Finchdean Chapel, and after the service, come from Finchdean Chapel, then to Dinnerlin End, and on a Sunday evening, catch a bus back to Rowan's Castle. That was on a Sunday. But again, that was in the late 50s, and later than that. Yes. One thing for buses in those days, if you were a young boy, or indeed anybody, you could virtually howl it on the road, certainly from Rowan's Castle to Horndean, and you could ask the driver, I want to go to the fourth haze past the Conga Tree, and that's where you'd be let off, and you could get off because that's where your auntie lived, and then you could jump back on the bus provided you waved it down and come back home. Yes.
Yeah.
There has in fact been people interested in local history in the village for many years. Even this man called Cotton, who'd done the paintings, did make a few notes about what he saw and what he painted. In the 1930s, there was a man called Percy Elliott who wrote for the local paper, which would have been the Hampshire Telegraph, I think, in those days, or the local version of that. And he lived for a while, it is believed, in Bowes Hill. He was called in nominate, and that's how he wrote his articles. And he wrote about smugglers, the general worsening of conditions in the village, in fact, even those days. He called the village Bungalow Town, because of the masses of mental bungalows being built in the village, and he wasn't very happy about that at all. In the 1950s, the local postmaster called Mr. Adams inherited a lot of this work and copied it from the archives, and he became friends with Clark Jarvis and took away lots of Clark Jarvis' work and rewrote them and made articles which he wrote for the paper and some for his own use. He claims to have fame in the base of Chawton Church records dating back to the 1530s, which he rescued and donated to the museums. He also borrowed lots of stuff from villagers and didn't return it at times, but that's beside the point. I'm not saying too much slander in the comments. And he was power behind the 1953 coronation program, which he wrote an article for, with the help of other villagers. This, I think, encouraged Cliff Miles to take a lot of interest, and Clifford was very much a village person, and he was on the council for many, many years, and with Jack Levitt and people of that ilk, helped the village on a footing which it had in the 1950s of friendliness and not being filled in and not having too many planning applications. and the grass and the recreation grain, and the look of the village as it is these days. Sometime in 1977, he put on another exhibition for the, again for the Queen's 25th Jubilee, and again I wasn't involved in that at all. Things then didn't take too much action at all until a man called Norman Green started a course for local historians, which at the time I thought, this, that seems interesting, I'll go along to that. I had already begun to collect together a few bits and pieces, mostly because I started an interest in old postcards. And I started collecting old postcards and views of the village, and I said, go around and see Cliff and I. I said, look, what do you think of this? And he's just showing me some more, and then he's showing me some the articles which he had, and I got hold of this copy of the Coronation Programme myself, and I read it through, and he gave me a lot of encouragement. So it's got to be done, it's got to be started and put together. You're a young man, you've got a lot more energy than me, because he was getting on then. And he showed me a lot of Cliff Miles' items. He put me in touch with some other villagers. He said, look, this villager is interested as well. And I went and saw them, and then, oh yes, well, they showed me some old articles they had, and I had access in those days to a photocopy at work, so I started photocopying them and piecing things together. Norman Green then sort of got me a lot more interested, and he volunteered to come and give a lecture in the parish hall about the very same smugglers which everyone thinks they know about. There are quite a lot of articles written about all around the place. And he had written a book, well researched book, about the smugglers. We had just about started at a local history group by then, based in the coffee pot, with the help of Mrs. Loma, who used to write those days, and Bill West from Upper Road, who always gives any new club a lot of support. And Cliff Myers gave us support, and some older villagers of that ilk who said, yes, we've got to get this going, form a club, get it properly organised. Norman Green then was our sort of first sort of contact, so we felt to gauge the publicity. And we advertised as well, we got proper tickets printed, and we held it in a large parish hall, and from as far as I can remember, 172 people turned up. They were absolutely full, the parish hall, it was chock-a-block. These people had all paid, I think it's quite a 5 shillings, I think, each, to come and listen to this man talking. He was quite pleased with this large fee, and after that we thought, well yes, there's massive support for local history in this village. I'd already by then been to Havant Library, Havant Museum, lived in Portsmouth. I've been in touch with a man in charge of local history at Portsmouth University, and met some people who've now become good friends from Havant and from the Havant area local history group. And they said, yes, you need one in Rowan's Castle. I said, there isn't one in Rowan's Castle. There's one at Lortleville, there's one at Petersfield, there's one at Westbourne, there's not one in Rowan's Castle. The whole of that area is your pigeon. They said it'll be a very long job. They said you'll get 20 people at the first one, you'll get 15 at the next one, you'll get 8 at the next lecture. They said you'll want to give up because you won't write anything for 6 years, and it'll be 15 years, he said, before anyone showed any interest whatsoever. Okay, fair enough, I said. And that's how it happened. The first lectures were very poorly attended. We should think 22 was a good crowd, a good audience. And this was 1979, the very early 80s now I'm talking about. And since then, so apart from the two books I've written about the history of the village, two very small pamphlets to celebrate the anniversary of the church and the anniversary of D-Day, Jonathan Dix has now written a very well researched article. A man from outside the village has written an article on the village. A young lad doing a university thesis has written a history of the village, based a lot on what I've told him, a lot of my papers, but again, very much a lot of what he's done himself. And the History Society now is very well, doing very well. We get 48, 55 at every meeting. We get our group visits, which we do, and the last one of those had 38 people attending. There's one, in fact, as I speak tomorrow night, which are going on to Boxgrove Priory. And there's a massive amount of records I've got at home, which are available to anyone to look at. I mean, they are mine, in effect, that I've collected most of them together and paid for a photocopy myself, but they're still available for people to come and look at. And each year we find a little bit more, not quite so much as those first heady days when we used to get, I used to get so many articles, I don't know what to do with them, but it's there now, it's in some sort of order, and I can usually find something within 2 days if I'm asked for something. Sort this for a sec. Is there a, between the houses, probably as late as very late 1960s, there are many, many fields. I try to remember a few of them. There was one at the bottom of the recreation ground, virtually opposite the parish hall. And in these fields, there were just horses, that was all, belonging to, I suppose I had to say, the slightly richer children or the richer parents in the village. The other side, of course, of this field, of course, were the allotment gardens, which went from there all the way from the parish hall to Bowes Hill. A massive amount of allotments, some in very well, very good condition, some not quite so well. The footpath, of course, is where the footpath is now, and we go along there from a shortcut from home to the recreation ground. There was very little thieving. I think you've got to say there was, we didn't thieve, we didn't destroy. We just looked and carried on walking. There was another field on the sharp corner of Links Lane, opposite the golf club. I can't remember that was behind that. I think that one always seemed to be behind that tall hedge, from what I can remember. Further up, there was a pathway from Links Lane to Bowes Hill. It was not the official footpath. It was kind of a wide, desolate track. There were some more fields there, which in fact backed onto the top of the recreation ground. There were another field above the allotments and between Bowes Hill, which was approached by that track, which is still there in Bowes Hill, next to the seat and the bus stop. There's a kind of a wide driveway, and then there was more fields, two at least I think, with horses in. There was that field at the bottom of Uplands Road, as I said, which wasn't used for horses ever, as far as I can remember. There were fields at the bottom of the drift, of course, opposite what used to be Wally Francis' shop before they built the houses on it. There were more at the top of Red Hill, opposite the nearly opposite the school, and as you went to the church. This was not so much a field, it was just a kind of a barren area with a large pond in it. It probably belonged to Hazelden House, but it was just a field. There were more allotment gardens behind the rectory. This would have been, well, in fact, between the rectory and the old rectory along Manor Court Road. And of course there was allotment gardens in Durrance, not quite where they are now, but one field up near what's now Durrance Flats. And probably Durrance Flats was probably built on a little bit of the allotment ground. There was a very small allotment gardens in Wellsworth footpath, that's the footpath between Uplands Road and this Wellsworth, and they belonged to the Kent House tenants. In fact, my father had one, and Mr. Foss had one, my father had one, and Mr. Moat, I think, had the other. I think there was only three, in a little area, triangle area of ground, which is still there now, heavily overgrown, and with electricity substation in it. But that was a small little allotment gardens for people in Uplands Road. When we moved into Uplands Road, of course, everyone used to grow vegetables in their back garden, and the front gardens were for show and for flowers. And when I say everybody, nearly everybody, as far as I can remember, had chickens in their back garden as well. And our back garden led then, in fact, to another field where there was another horse and a tin hut with stable. And I can remember this field because it was had a horse vehicle by Judith Olding, who lived in Rose Hill. So that shows that these fields were used by villagers, and as I say, it was just for the girls to get their horses in. Also in my days, the village were full of dales, which were always great areas to go and play in. And they're all heavily overgrown, the dales are in the village, although they've been filled in. But as a child, they were everywhere. There was one on the golf course, which is named the Golf Tee. It's been well filled in, and it was in this dal with the back of Links Lane. And you can find quite interesting things there, of course. I can remember once being a brochure given to a Rolls Royce. It was leather bound and had colourful, and this was the most wonderful thing you could ever find. Because we all used to collect magazines and brochures about cars. We used to go down to Robin Hall and Mr. Barrett and beg and borrow ones from them. Or of course you could only get Morris Myers and Austin 8s and cars like that. But to find this Rolls Royce brochure, it was a wonderful thing. But like I say, this dial has been filled in, and there's now one of the tees for the golf club. I can't remember which one. The golf course just there, in fact, has been extended to the right if you're looking towards the Holt. This was done to make it into a championship length. You'll probably get more details, of course, in the history of the golf club. But I can remember that being done, and I can remember searching for golf balls in that hedge, because I used to get caught up in there a lot. There was dales in Woodbury Lane, called Clarksdale, which has now been well filled in. The dale in Mays Coppice used to be a lot deeper, which appeared to be a lot deeper in my days. And there was a stream in there, which used to come across from the railway line. And we used to play in there a lot when we were kids. And just from there, just up from there, there used to be a crossing across the railway line. It was an official crossing because it had a gate which you could open, and the conductor well was broken. And there were signs up saying, look and listen for trains before you go across. This is more to do with the history of the village than anything else, because it was the road, the path itself is a continuation of the drift if you look on the map. And so obviously went back to the days when they built the railway line, and the man did have a right of access there. There's a dale in Woodbury Lane again, just the other, which gets filled up when the Lavance rises. This is just behind the wall, just before you get to the footbridge across the same Lavance stream. There was also, again, talking about people dumping their rubbish, there was fine places to go and search for when you're children. There was one behind the chapel, a fine old rubbish dump, which must have been there for many, many years. Certainly, we had many British shops in those days. Once again, there was, from what I can remember, there was a very strong divide in the British shops. You either used one or you used the other. Very seldom did you go into any other shop. But starting from Bowes Hill, if you like, there was one at the bottom of Bowes Hill, which was Foster's very long time ago, but then it became Needham's, and then it became a spa supermarket, I think, or as I say, spa supermarket, a very small spa shop. Then just around the corner, because you had the large block, which is near the coffee shop, which should be called Wingers and Hearns.